examples under Al's question. One is lockdown of the classifier. This is a strictly scientific process question. Could have been reviewed by the CPC, CRPRC. In fact, it should be a checkoff on every single study that's going to go to translation or humans. And I'd like to know, is that something you know is essential or consider essential and look for? Yes or no? And if it was a consideration in this case. And the second, maybe let's go one question at a time. It's only two.
I definitely agree that I think a predictor which is being applied in the clinical setting should be locked down. And I think that the understanding of the CPC at the time was that it was locked down.
So that turns out in retrospect to be a big misunderstanding because it was being modified every time there was another inquiry from Baggerly.
But in terms of in the clinical research projects, I would stand to the fact that the predictors was locked down and that I took the efforts at the initiation of the trials of locking down the classifier so that it was applied in a constant manner throughout the clinical trials.
That's very helpful. We'll come back and let you elaborate on that later.
Absolutely.
The second is a general question for the IRB and the CPRC. We had an extensive part of our last meeting devoted to the kinds of studies that can be done to more reliably and efficiently advance diagnostic test panels to clinical applications and clinical utility. And one of the major strategies is called the prospective retrospective study, where you actually take well-characterized clinical specimens and apply the classifier and see how it performs. In this case, it could be said that that stage was leapt over to go right into a marker-guided clinical trial. Was there any discussion of that and of the sense that this was a big leap, missing an important normal step or desirable step?
All right. So I think at the time in 2006 when this study was being reviewed initially, one of the studies was first being reviewed, the understanding, I think, of the entire scientific community was probably not at the place where it is today in 2011. So in retrospect, I think that it's very clear that a different study design would have been appropriate for that first study. But at the time, I don't think that was entirely clear. And there was discussion about what the study design should look like. But I think that was something that the CPRC's mission is not to design the research for the investigator, but if we had the knowledge that we have now, we probably would provide a different recommendation in terms of whether that type of study should have gone forward. So I think that's something that we've learned, but I think we've learned that as a larger scientific community as well.
Yeah, thank you.
I don't have anything to add to that.
Ironically, these studies now end up being on your list of the high percentage of studies with very small enrollments.
Yes. I mean, this is an area that's going to evolve in this new community approach to design. I think what Michael said, traditionally, a review committee wouldn't design a study for an investigator, but I hope in the new paradigm where we'll end up is if your community of peers says this is not the best way to do the study, then the consensus has to drive it. Again, keeping in mind that sometimes the rugged individual who disagrees with the community actually turns out to be right. So there needs to be some sensitivity to the balance that exists.
And there's a difference between designing it for the investigator and approving the science and protecting patient interests. Gail, we better move on just because time is running short.
Okay. So in the Duke trials, who made decisions to not obtain an IDE from the FDA?
This was a process that was under discussion by IRB members, by IRB leadership, not at a particular meeting, but by the IRB leadership, and I led that discussion. The thinking initially was vastly different from what it is today, what it would be today. The thinking, as we understood it at FDA, was vastly different from where we understand it, where we know it to be today, in part as reaffirmed by Dr. Gutierrez last Friday. initially, and I'll simply walk through the process that IRBs are expected to go through, was safety or effectiveness of a device being evaluated? Initially, I thought no. We thought no. Initially, we thought that the device was the assessment of the tumor for its genomic characteristics. What we didn't pick up on was that it was the algorithm. Once we heard from the Western IRB's review of the protocol for an institution apart from ours that was a part of our study, this is a part of the Duke Oncology Network, using Western IRB as its IRB of record. This we learned of in late June 2009. We paused and rethought it. The thinking that one has to go through is, if an IDE is needed, and the worm said, yes, an IDE is needed, yes, it's a significant risk device, and no, an IND is not needed, or no, an IND is not needed. What we did was, since we didn't think an IND was needed either, let's examine the IDE question. And remember, this was occurring after, which occurred late in 08, that one of our investigators, Dr. Fembo, consulting with the drug branch, was told that his study, which is similar, not POTI's technology, but very similar technology, genomic predictor model dictating therapy, that this did not require an IND, and there was no mention of whether an IDE was an issue. We interpreted the fact that no IND was needed to fit our thinking, and no mention of the IDE also to fit our thinking. What we have to do is the IRB is say, if this is a device, then does it meet exemption criteria? Or if it doesn't meet exemption criteria, can it or is it a non-significant risk device? And if it's not a non-significant risk device, it is a significant risk device and therefore requires an IDE. If it is a non-significant risk device, it qualifies, other features are met, and they would have been in this situation, an abbreviated IDE, which the IRB, in effect, issues on behalf of FDA. That's simply the process that currently exists as far as the regs are concerned. We felt that this was a more than minimal risk study, but we didn't feel like this was a significant risk device study, because we didn't think the device created a substantial risk of harm to the safety, rights, and welfare of the individual. And that is a paraphrase, and I can tell you exactly what the words say. I think I can do it right now. Presents a potential for serious risk to the health, safety, or welfare of the subject. That's the theme, the common theme throughout all of the features that determine when something is a significant risk device. We didn't think this device did that because the prediction led to the use of acceptable therapies either way. It wasn't standard therapy versus an investigational product or combination. It was what we thought were two standard therapies, as we discussed earlier today. So our conclusion then was that this was a non-significant risk device. Now, about the time we reached this conclusion, things shut down for other reasons not related to this device question. Accrual shut down. We had a basis for thinking that we had cancer center director support for continuing people on the program of treatment that they were allocated to as a result of the research. And we didn't therefore act on this conclusion of the significant risk, non-significant risk device determination until the point where we reopened the study in early 2010, and frankly, overlooked the question of making that non-significant risk device determination. Some would ask, and I'll just lay it out here, would ask, doesn't the needle biopsy say then that the use of the device, depending upon that needle biopsy, make it a significant risk device? At the time, we didn't think so. This was back again in 2009. FDA guidance, final guidance, came out in June of 2010 that made it very clear that invasive sampling of a person in order for that device to be applied does make it a significant risk device. We didn't think so at the time, based upon our analysis and also based upon our understanding of what was not draft guidance, but final guidance.
Was that the basis of the Western IRB's determination? Do you know what made them decide what they decided?
I don't recall exactly, but I think that was the basis for it, and we just simply, I think that was the basis. I can't go further than that. I have the letter available to me, but I just don't have it in my head that well.
There were certainly many agents available that were part of standard of care for which clinical caregivers could choose, from which they could choose. If it weren't for the fact that we would understand the likelihood that each of those could have a different effect across patients, there'd be no basis for pursuing a predictor. So when you develop a predictor to define or guide selection, that becomes part of that defines an experimental regimen whose efficacy and safety inherently could be considerably different from that of caregivers' independent decision-making about which agent to choose. So it becomes an experimental regimen that can have different efficacy and safety from standard of care that wouldn't engage that predictor. Go ahead.
To that point, there was never any question that this was a research question. This was research. This was not simply standard of care activities. We were not at all misled by the notion that because these were generally viewed across the community as comparable therapies, that therefore this was no longer research. It was a very important research question, and we understood that.
If you were reviewing it today, if you were reviewing this today, would you indicate that an IDE would be necessary for...
Absolutely. And now we have guidance that we didn't have in 2009 that's very clear. We have final guidance, number one, and we have many communications with our colleagues at FDA about this. And as Dr. Gutierrez pointed out last Friday, we went from a murky area to a much more clarified area, which is where we are now. And we won't face this same problem again because of the clarity that's present.
But I take it your yes answer is not because of the needle biopsy. It's because of changing the therapies that people would get so that they might no longer get the average, not very good result, but that they would possibly benefit, and possibly, if the predictor were adverse, not benefit, have an adverse effect.
I apologize. I didn't hear the first part of your statement. I apologize.
Yeah. You said nowadays you would certainly go to the FDA for an IDE. But just a minute ago, you said you would go to the FDA because of the needle biopsy.
No.
I want to make sure it was based on this argument that you're taking a two-sided outcome approach to
FDA,
the test of the classifier.
FDA has made very clear several things. Number one, that the use of an invasive biopsy makes a device more than minimal risk. Therefore, an IDE is required in the setting where research is being conducted on a new device.
Right.
Unambiguous, number one. Number two, FDA has made perfectly clear that any new technology is subject to an IDE unless FDA says no. Any new technology. It's the newness and the innovation nature of it that has taken away any cloud of uncertainty.
Okay, thank you.
Made it very clear, and we're grateful for that.
Anything else? What we'd like to do is at least begin the discussion of the next section, which we've already begun in a lot of the earlier interactions. It's on conflict of interest. And to introduce this, we'd like to refer to a couple of references and then some examples and then get into the management plan discussions with Dr. McKinney. In the TMQ document, Duke has recognized that the risk of financial and professional conflicts of interest at the investigator and institutional level, in addition to acknowledging those, you've advocated, therefore, oversight from independent experts. The Discovery of Process Working Group has also recognized the need for a clear understanding about how conflict of interest specifically has been handled at Duke and the importance of the risk of conflict of interest, where we've noted that it's not only financial, universities get first cut profits on patents and other financial issues, but there's also interest in protecting reputations of the institution, reputations of investigators. So certainly, as has been already indicated, attention to and addressing conflict of interest issues is certainly of considerable importance. In a couple of specific instances, I'd like to start by giving a couple. The informed consent for the lung metagene study, the CLGB 30506, was dated on May 11, 2010, and doesn't appear to acknowledge that the study chair, David Harpole, has a patent application that was dated several months before that, on January 14th of 2010, for the LMS predictor for lung cancer recurrence, nor was there an acknowledgement of related financial interests of co-chair Anil Patti in that informed consent. In general, it's our understanding that Dr. Patti was either the PI of the SOT trials at various times or otherwise at least significantly involved in leadership, where these trials were evaluating genomic signatures for which he held or had applied for a patent, or for which he might have had financial interest in companies that were providing services directly related to the genomic predictors that were under investigation in the trials. If so, these issues seem to be creating significant conflicts of interest. What were the measures that were employed to address these? And also, were these potential conflicts of interest fully disclosed and in a timely fashion disclosed to all relevant parties that would need to know this, including any federal agencies that were involved in funding these trials or related research projects?
Ross, I think you should take that up.
Okay. So let me make sure that I have the question correct, because it was a long question.
Yes.
So what measures were taken to inform the various parties once we identified that there were conflicts? What measures were taken to inform the federal government in regard to conflicts?
And in part based on our looking through informed consents, noting that these weren't acknowledged in the informed consents, which we would have thought would have been one of the important ways that should have been clear.
Okay. The answer on the who we inform and how we inform. So, when the Conflict of Interest Committee first began to identify this and establish management plans related to. So Drs. Nevins and Ginsberg first had management plans related to this intellectual property going back to 06. Management plans, I believe Dr. Nevins first was in 07, clearly had one in 08 related to the intellectual property. At the time those happen, we generally notify the IRB. I will say, I use the word generally because I do not remember the specifics of the management plan. I could look it up. But in general, we notify the IRB anytime there's a management plan that could affect human research subjects so that they can include language to the effect that an individual or Duke has a conflict. The or Duke aspect of that became significantly greater when we created an institutional conflict of interest policy that went into place in January 10. So we've been in discussions and actually practicing institutional conflict of interest management going back to a first meeting that was somewhere around 04. But we have a committee and a formal policy as of 10. So we notify the IRB. We notify the feds. We, in fact, I think for quite a while, notified the feds more often than any other institution about potential conflicts because we're very systematic about sending in our notifications to the federal government anytime that there's a conflict. But one of the issues that this particular case raised was what is the threshold that should be used for when you begin to, and the other thing is we notified all the PIs. So as part of the management plan, when we tell a faculty member that they're now going to have some restriction, like disclosure or publications, and they are collaborating with people who are working on grants or clinical trials, we notify those PIs. So for example, Dr. Nevins's plan said that we were going to notify all the PIs of the clinical trials that Dr. Nevins and Ginsberg had conflicts. So those that kind level of information, internal exchange was ongoing. But the question is where you draw the line. What this particular case illustrated in many ways was that debate about when you begin to include management in the process of developing intellectual property. When does it become real enough that you should start notifying? And different institutions have chosen different standards. Our current standard is as soon as you begin discussions around licensure or with the IRB, either one, then we're going to be managing the conflict. But that's a discussion that continues to be ongoing because people don't really have clear standards. And I don't think that the new federal regs that will be coming out will help us in regards to development of new intellectual property and at what point we begin to manage that IP as a risk.
So you've gotten into management plans. That's appropriate. Let me pursue that for a minute and then come back to some of the questions that I was asking. So institutions generally are responsible for having management plans in place for addressing investigators' financial conflict of interest. And is it, do you agree with my understanding that these management plans typically include stipulations such as disclosures on consent forms or barring investigators from being a PI in a trial when he or she has perceived conflict of interest that would be significant?
Yes.
In this setting, then, as we go back and look at the two examples that I gave in the 30506 trial and in the SOT 703 trial, where lead investigators had significant professional and financial conflicts of interest, not to mention what you were appropriately mentioning, also institutional conflict of interest, it appears that the informed consents didn't acknowledge those conflicts. Shouldn't that be routinely acknowledged?
I would expect that it should be.
So if we talk about specifically the case of Dr. Potty with the management plans, did the institution have in place for Dr. Potty management plans in those three SOT trials?
We don't. We had it around the intellectual property, not around the trials. So the basis on which we generally develop our management plans is the individual and the company or pre-company in this particular case that existed. So it's not around a specific trial.
So there wouldn't have been then specific management plans in place for the statement of task, three statement of task trials that are specific?
There was, but it was around the intellectual property, not around the trial. So the distinction I'm making is that our basis, our format for deciding how to set up a management plan, because a management plan reflects a conflict in a given, the relationship between the investigator and a company that then creates in their research a secondary influence that could affect their decision making. And that goes actually all the way through their basic science and their clinical research. So we inform the IRB that we're aware of this particular conflict of interest, and in this case it was around the intellectual property that then became cancer guide diagnostics. But the management plans went back to the intellectual property of genomic predictors and just was generic said, in regard to genomic predictors that are likely to be developed into companies. So we start to manage it.
I mean, another interpretation, I just want to make sure I've got this right, because actually, there are two things to mention here. But first, Dr. Potty was aware, based on his management plan, that he had certain obligations related to having intellectual property. And that was clear related to any trials to be done that might be affected by the intellectual property. Is that
Dr. Potty's first management plan that affected these particular clinical trials was issued in June of 2009.
Okay. So three related questions that follow up on this are, shouldn't such plans or other processes that might have been in place, if not specific management plans, precluded someone from being PI when there were such significant financial and professional conflicts of interest? Were there investigations then to ensure that Dr. Potty was in compliance with those plans or processes? And wasn't it problematic that he had ongoing patent applications and involvement in cancer guide diagnosis company?
Well, just let me try to clarify one thing, because it's been a source of heated discussion over the last 2 weeks in particular with me. And the question, a lot of investigators believe that filing intellectual property is not the trigger. It's when you form a company or when you have a relationship with a company that's trying to make something of the intellectual property. There are a lot of intellectual property claims that come in. I believe our policy now is any filing of intellectual property is the trigger.
Right. Once you have filed a patent application for something, as I say, you either are talking about a licensure event, which then declares that it has economic value, because licensure is a declaration of economic value, or you're getting into human investigation and talking to the IRB. Either one is sufficient to trigger the need for consideration of management, because either one means that it starts to have the potential for economic value.
So I would have assumed, and I think you're saying now it's your view, that if you have a patent application or an involvement in a cancer guide diagnosis company, that inherently creates something that should be disclosed, if not preventing you from serving in a leadership role in a protocol.
I would say that there are many examples of people who have patent applications or full patents where, in fact, the economic value is insufficient to justify restricting them in performing as the PI on the research. So there's a difference between those that actually have economic potential and those that may be incidental. And
so,
part of the job of the committee is to assess what the association is between the patent and the potential risk that might be involved.
In this case, it wouldn't apply that you would assume
no,
that
this one we thought it was real, and we began to think, we began to manage it going back to discussions that occurred in 06, where we gave guidance before as they were designing the trials as to what our expectations would be.
Which was what?
Can I just ask? This is a potential sort of communication loop that might need to get closed or for our own recommendations. I'm still trying to understand the communication between the Conflict of Interest Committee and the IRB. When the Conflict of Interest Committee evaluates the intellectual property, and not a specific trial, so then just to be clear, it's up to the IRB to connect the dots when a protocol comes in by that person, that they sort of know in the ether has a general conflict of interest.
There are two ways that they know. Both we send the management plan, and in fact, the person who's our IRB liaison attends most of our conflict of interest meetings. So they are present. So they're very aware. This was not something that was occurring in a vacuum. They were aware in this particular case of the links to Dr. Pody. And we've had subsequent discussions about the nature of the kind of language we would like to see by agreement between the Conflict of Interest Committee and the IRB, the kind of language we'd like to see included in our consent documents, both around personal conflict and institutional conflict, and how to make sure that we catch every case, because it is important that people be aware. On the other hand, the specifics of which investigator is the one who has the relationship with either the IP or the company is probably not as important as the fact, the generic issue, that there are investigators who stand to benefit and the institution stands to benefit. So we're working to try and make language that we think will best inform subjects. Because if they're told that investigator Dr. Pody, for example, has a financial interest but they never see him, they may not interpret it correctly. Where if we say there are investigators who are on this protocol who invented this technology, then they'll be able to correctly interpret and make a decision about participation regarding
Ross,
the benefit ratio.
To the degree that you're able to, this may be helped because I noted the expression of concern around the first management plan you mentioned was in mid to late 2009, and I saw some of our board members react to that. To the degree that you're able to, if you could explain the nature and timing of Dr. Pody's conflict, one around the IP and the second around the later developing aspects, that may provide some reassurance or concern, I don't know, in terms of this link.
Well, that was when we were informed that he was part of the actual intellectual property filings that were ongoing. I mean, we knew it had been his work, but it's hard. We were aware that he was part of the team, but we really became aware that he was part of the intellectual property and then put him on to, gave him a specific management plan that tied to the intellectual property.
So do you have the facts to tell us who were the named patent applicants?
And the list was
who are the faculty involved in the two companies, the Cancer Guide Diagnostics and the
Expression Analysis Inc.
Okay. Expression Analysis Inc., I can tell you that one's on the tip of my tongue. That was Joan Evans, Holly Dressman, and Mike West. They were the founders when it was established back in 2001. The people who were listed on the licensing agreement, which is really where it ends up being the key document that established what level of interest various people had, was the licensing agreement. And it was a very complicated document that I can't remember the exact name, was approximately 17 people. And different licensure with different elements, different tumors, that if the signature proved to be valid for a given tumor, they would get some percentage of the revenues that came from any royalties that related to that specific tumor.
Somebody must have thought there was economic potential.
What?
Somebody must have thought there was economic potential.
And Ross, that licensing event occurred in?
January of 10th. And in fact, it was also one of those lessons learned was that the information was not conveyed to those people who were conflicted, that they were listed as part of the licensing event, until the Conflict of Interest Committee, when we were given that document, began to contact them to say, we did not see on your annual disclosure that you had listed. So one of those failings that we have learned is the need to make sure that people who are conflicted know they're conflicted. Now, of course, that does mean that they didn't operate in a conflicted way because they weren't aware, but we cannot know in retrospect when they learned that they did have a conflict.
Ross, among the 17 things listed, were they all individuals or were some of them practice plans or universities? They were all individuals.
They were individuals.
But Ross, it's also true that under the university guidelines, there's a split that goes to the yes. lab and a split that goes to the university.
So right. So this is, and some of these numbers were very small percentage figures. So in fact, this engendered on the part of both the institutional and personal conflict of interest committee a discussion. What does 1% of a diagnostic test where you're getting 1% of the distribution that is only one-third of the amount, because the distribution typically is one-third. So you're talking about 1% of one-third. What is the likelihood that this is going to hit our threshold of $25,000 in 1 year? And we're guessing, you know, we're trying to go, God, you know, and what's the likelihood that that level of conflict would incent somebody to behave in a different way in their analysis of data? And we were really struggling with how to use that information.
Do you want to tell us how this worked from your point of view?
So I had a, as Ross indicated, I had some discussions with the with him as Vice Dean of Research and Conflict of Interest Office back in the in 2005, 2006 timeframe. We were aware that there was this community of the area of cancer diagnostics in general was something that looked promising. The data looked promising. We knew from discussions with a number of industry groups that there was going to be a requirement to provide additional validations beyond what was already in the published literature. But nonetheless, I think. The idea of truly being able to translate these technologies such that they could provide a benefit to patients was something that we were extremely interested in. My management plan, I think, was quite clear. I don't recall exactly when it was initiated, but probably about a year later, which really stated very explicitly that I could not be the PI on any human studies related to this intellectual property, and that I needed to inform various organizations or through publications, you know, disclose that this might be the case. But I have to say that as Ross has indicated, I had no idea who else besides Dr. Nevins was on the various. The patent application or applications that were related to this. It was just something that that was handled elsewhere. Was not handled by me. When the trials were designed, Dr. Potty designed the 0602 trial, Dr. Reddy designed the 0703 trial, and Dr. Markham designed the breast cancer study. Certainly Dr. Reddy and Dr. Markham were the PIs of the trials that they designed, and Dr. Garst was the trial for 0602 from the outset. I actually do not know exactly how that decision was made, and I do know that there was an interim period after she left the institution to put another PI that Dr. Potty was the interim PI
He was PI from July 08 to July 09.
Yeah. Right.
So, as we've already mentioned, it's not just Dr. Potty. Dr. Harpole was the PI for the CLGB 30506 study, and he had an application in 6 months before the informed consents came out that didn't acknowledge it. What are the measures? What would you define to be the measures that should be employed in these settings for the nature of the even at 1% of one-third, significant potential for financial conflict of interest, if not real, at least perceived? What should be done? And it should the informed consents not at least include acknowledgement of such potential conflict?
So I agree that the informed consent should consistently demonstrate and give people the knowledge that they need to be able to decide whether the investigators with whom they're working might be biased. It informs the informed consent process as well as their decision to participate, because if you know that the person stands to gain as they explain the story to you, you become more skeptical. And that skepticism is the kind of thing you would hope becomes a part of the consent process as a result of knowledge of this. I think that the lessons learned are that when licensing events occur, when intellectual property, when patent applications are filed, all of the listed names should be conveyed both to the institution and to those people who are managing things like the IRB and the Conflict of Interest Office, and that all of the individuals who are involved should be informed. I cannot understand why it has not to this point been routine, but it is. Basically, the information at this point primarily gets conveyed to the lead inventor, and they are expected to convey it to other people. I think a better system needs to be in place, and that should be a routine universally.
And I just want to echo Ross's comment. I think this just goes to Dr. Oman's question, at least to me, was if we had it to do over again, in retrospect, I think having a complete disclosure of all of the inventors on any of the relevant patents would have been extremely helpful in clearing, making it clear what the COI issues are and sort of putting the appropriate firewalls in place, which clearly were not. So, this just seems like a relatively simple, potentially simple fix to a very complicated problem. And would also, in addition to the disclosures that Ross mentioned, I think given the process of accountability that we're asking our institutional leaders to take on, be they center directors, institute heads, or department heads, they need to know. They need to understand the conflicts that exist within their organization. Otherwise, it's even in a review process, without having that critical piece of information, it may not be as rigorous or as detailed as it needs to be.
I might, however, add that there is a complication, which is in general, and this is not just Duke, offices of science and technology try to some degree to mask the meaning of those invention disclosures and not to reveal them to the world. So the language that they use to describe them is often extremely vague and non-informative. So it can be very hard to keep track of these things because they don't want other people to get proprietary advantage or to know that, oh, Duke is working on X and they are this far along in the patenting process. We must therefore accelerate our patenting. So once things go into the patent system, they become public. And so the result is that people are very vague in all these disclosures. And that culture makes management of this kind of information more difficult.
I want to make three quick points. Number one, I don't want to leave you with the impression that the kind of parsing that you heard about here is typical of the culture of Duke and its clinical research. This was an unusual cultural cloister, where things were amazingly parsed, as you've heard, where one person didn't know what the next person was doing, even within the same research group. And as we'll talk about when we talk about publications, even among co-authors. And this is not typical of our culture. Second point is, I think this issue of public disclosure is critical. It's an evolving thing, but I think at a lot of institutions until very recently, what you did with companies was considered very private. It was considered intrusive to say anything about it. We're now in an era where we know that relationships with industry are going to be on everybody's website, and at least in significant parts of our institution, there is a public website you can go to where you can read about all relationships with industry. I just filled out my National Institutes of Aging Council form yesterday. It took an entire day. I'm still not sure I got it all right, so it's a little complicated, but it can be done. And then I think the last point is this point between thinking of translating, filing intellectual property, the details of what's in the filing related to proprietary advantage, and then forming a relationship with a company where the financial interest is really obvious. There's a continuum there that I think deserves careful thought, where I can just say it's not clear to a lot of our translational investigators. We want them to develop new things that are helpful to people. Commercialization is the route. We don't want to make it impossible, but I think all the issues that you brought up in this case say that keeping things secret is a really bad idea.
Yeah, we understand, and it is a continuum. The thought is an important milestone once you've submitted a patent application.
I think it is.
So if people are willing, could we go another 10 minutes and then still have our 30 minutes and just delay it slightly, because I think there are only a couple more issues here under conflict of interest.
Let me ask one quick question. Let me ask the question, flip side to Dr. Folletta, the question about the IRB. Is there a provision for either a declaration or an attestation of individuals having a conflict of interest or an IP relative to what they're submitting? I realize that Dr. McKinney said that there is a liaison who actually, from the IRB, who sits on the conflict of interest committee. But is there a process, a more deliberative, explicit process by which the PI can attest to whether or not there is perceived conflict of interest or real conflict of interest or an IP that either is in process or actually has been issued?
There is a sign-off that the principal investigator makes at the time of submission of a protocol and at the time of periodic continuing review as to whether or not the investigator has a conflicting interest. We don't go into the level of detail that your question suggested in terms of prompting them to think about these other things.
But how about IPs? Patents?
The expectation would be that the principal investigator would understand that if the investigator had intellectual property presence or a patent, that this would be included in that.
A comment. I mean, if you want to talk about one of the least favorite things of the faculty at Duke University, it's the sign-off you have to do to submit an IRB protocol. It just drives you crazy. But I think there is probably room for misunderstanding about the way it's worded. I hesitate to add anything at risk of being stoned by the faculty, but I think there is a misunderstanding by a lot of faculty about what having filed IP means in terms of conflict relative to actually having a relationship with a company.
And there, I'm sorry, there is no explanation, or there is nothing declarative beyond whether or not you have a real or perceived COI. That's the way it's stated.
I would have to pull out the form to tell you precisely how I've said it. I don't have that in my head, but I can assure you that Rob, who is an investigator who signs these things on occasion, his comments would apply. I have no doubt about that.
So on the form, it's a pretty detailed list of things. I think the one area of weakness, as I say again, maybe you filed a provisional patent. It's not a patent yet. You don't have a company. You don't have so on and so forth. But you attest to that when you do your electronic signature, and you've also attested with Ross in the annual conflict of interest disclosure with an agreement that if it changes during the course of the year, you will notify within a certain period of time. Those two things can be matched up, and that's an enhancement which can be done electronically that I think we're now doing.
A couple more questions. The first one is actually a two-part question. So as you think about the policies and procedures with respect to conflict of interest at individual institutional levels, do those policies and procedures specifically address conflict of interest of members of IRB's data safety monitoring committees and of the conflict of interest committee itself? And the second part of the question is, were there any violations?
Office of Science
and Technology, all of them. And the second part is, are you aware of any conflicts for members of the IRB, for members of the Data Monitoring Committee, for members of the Conflict of Interest Committee with respect to the three Statement of Task trials?
I am not aware of any conflict other than the ones which you already know about. Conflicts by investigators, but the conflict in regard to the IRB.
I'm talking about members now of the Oversight Committee.
IRB COI Committee, no, I'm not aware of.
Are there formal conflict of interest policies about the Conflict of Interest Committee and its membership and the IRBs?
Each of the various committees have their own conflict of interest policy, but they all basically get back to recusal. That if you are in a situation where you should recuse yourself, there's an exploration, an expectation that you would declare your conflict and recuse yourself in the meeting. And all of them operate on that same basic principle, but each one has its own policy. There's not one uniform policy that applies to all those offices.
Well, we've asked you to help us understand a bit about membership and to do some pursuit of this. It's imperfect because we don't know all of the people and all of the affiliations. But we did notice that for the Data Safety Monitoring Board, which we all know has important oversight responsibilities, and the Data Safety Monitoring Board that was in place for the three SOT trials, you did provide to us the membership. At the original membership and the reconfigured membership, there were 5 members, and reconfigured, there were 4. In both instances, both for the original configuration and the reconfiguration, Dr. Robert Kratzky is listed as a member of the Data Safety Monitoring Board for these trials. And we noted that Dr. Kratzky also served with Dr. Potty as co-chair of the 30506 lung metagene study and is a co-author of the important August 10, 2006 New England Journal article that provided the evidence for the presentation, the claim of the lung metagene classifier, and that the emerging information from these studies, in fact, led to the retraction of the New England Journal article for which he was a co-author. And he was also mentioned by name in David Beer's letter to this committee dated May 1st, 2011, in which Dr. Beer described what he believed was an example of use of data without proper authorization in that New England Journal publication. So with these kinds of involvements, is it the thought that he wouldn't be conflicted to serve as a member of the Data Safety Monitoring Board for these three SOT trials?
I think we were not aware of the level of conflict, and he would not have been appropriate on the basis of what you've just said.
I'm pleased to hear the latter. I would have thought the same. The former, it wouldn't have been known since these were the fundamental studies that the Duke group was involved in and that the development of the predictors were based on, that he was a co-author and a leadership in that?
I think at the time that I was not aware of his relationship, nor were the other members of the COI office at the time that the DSMB Plus was created. We just weren't aware of those specific relationships. So we missed it.
Right. Well, not just you missed it. I mean, it's the obligation of the individual to recuse or inform. You know, this IOM committee, for example, every committee of the academy is required to go through a detailed bias and conflict of interest, potential conflict of interest discussion for the understanding of everybody else on the panel.
In fact, they sign off on a charter saying that they are not conflicted as part of the process of agreeing to become part of the member. We have refined that charter over time, but the charter does say you should not participate if you perceive any.
We're back to our trust criteria, which we'd love to rely on, but increasingly we get slightly skeptical.
Well, I mean, I think it sounds like you've given us new information that maybe we should have known, Tom, but Brett, I mean, it would be useful, I think, for us to investigate and get back to you specifically. There are many circumstances, as you know, where we may have, you and I have worked together in the past, and you may end up being on a committee that's overseeing a trial that I do or vice versa. And, you know, I could see how in this parsed environment that existed here, there could have been some rationale. Based on what you said, it doesn't sound like it was kosher, but We ought to find out the details and get back to him.
Can I interject one point? I don't know how germane this is to the conversation, but Dr. Fleming, I do just want to make the particular observation that the New England Journal of Medicine paper is focused solely on the lung metagene signature in terms of its content, which was part of the CALGB 30506 trial. The three studies in question at Duke, to which the DSMB was reviewing, and actually the fourth, if you would include the Phil Febbo trial, were all chemosensitivity signatures that do not, appear separately in the Nature Medicine work. So, I don't know how what bearing
that is
has.
Correct. That is correct. And I'm talking about the broader nature of professional interactions and involvement. Are there any other, we can break here, we're finished with this section, unless there are any other parting thoughts that anyone has to raise on conflict of interest. We will talk, though, beginning after lunch with specific issues around the IRB review process and certain aspects of conflict of interest there. So that will come up after lunch.
This is just one general comment, which is I can see in terms of formulating policy going forward, you could think about time frames over which people remain conflicted in much of the same way when you're on, an NIH study section, if you published with somebody within a 3-year time frame or a 5-year time frame, because it's not an endless size scientific community, and you can imagine that somebody may have had interactions with somebody on a trial, and then time's elapsed, and they've become, they're really not involved anyway professionally. So it might be worth thinking about in terms of those policies.
Okay, let me thank everybody for a very constructive and productive morning.